Hello everyone and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today I'm delighted to talk again to Imran Muller. You're most welcome, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you very much for having me on.
Pleasure to have you back. And since we last spoke, you graduated from Cambridge University. Congratulations from that, where you studied history. And now you work as a journalist at Middle East Eye. It's a fantastic magazine, newspaper online. I'll link to it in the description below. And in a recently published article on Middle East Eye, Imran tells us the fascinating story of how the 1931 World Islamic Congress in Jerusalem made Palestine an international cause. It was organized by Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin al-Husseini, and Indian Muslim activists. The gathering sought to present a unified Muslim front against Zionism and European colonialism. A very important story indeed. So perhaps you could take us through it, Imran. So over to you.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me on again. And delighted to talk to your audience about this. It's essentially a slice of nearly forgotten history. And it's the reason that I was sort of interested, the reason I know about it is because it's part of a broader research project that I have into essentially the international alliances across the Islamic world in the interwar period of the 20th century. So between the First World War and the Second World War, and I especially focus on the Ottoman imperial family in the last days of the empire and in exile in Europe and their relationship with the Muslims of the Indian subcontinent. And that's a sort of woefully understudied and understood story. And this story is really a smaller part of that larger history. And this is obviously about Palestine, which is what makes it so relevant to the political situation today, is why I wrote about it for Middle East Eye as a kind of historical piece, a piece of context. And what this is really about is the fact that we kind of take it for granted today, naturally, that Palestine is, everyone knows what the Palestinian cause is all about. And it's taken as an Islamic cause for all the Muslims. It's taken as an Arab cause and obviously fundamentally a Palestinian cause. But it wasn't always understood as this kind of international movement. And there was a period, obviously, when most Muslims in the world, including Muslim intellectuals and leaders and notables, didn't really understand it. So they didn't really know what the Zionist movement was. They sort of saw it as, you know, it's just another kind of local struggle, because there were lots of local struggles going on and they were against the same few sort of imperial powers.
Because there were tons of anti-colonial struggles going on at that time, weren't there? So this wasn't just, there was one, this was just one, they just one, it was a very important one, but of many. And now it's become, for many, the focal point of anti-colonial struggle today. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, struggle in, Algeria against the French was not considered at that time to be the struggle of the entire Islamic world. It was considered, you know, we have to show solidarity with Muslims in Algeria, you know, perhaps a common enemy, but it was not considered a great Islamic cause. And it was the same with Palestine as well. And so to set the scene a little bit, this history is in 1931. And what's going on here, obviously, is that Palestine is under the British mandate. So it's under British control. And there are a lot of Jewish leaders in Palestine, Zionist leaders who want to establish a Jewish homeland there. And then there's the opposite from the Muslim side. And everyone knows about the Balfour Declaration of 1917, where the British, it's really a statement of intent to establish a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And there were obviously very compelling reasons for them to do that, which is that the Jewish people were intensely persecuted, relentlessly persecuted across Europe. And Jewish leaders, many of them felt that liberal states in Europe were unable to sort of accommodate and actually tolerate them. And they were in a kind of constant state of precarity. And so that motivated Zionism. And there were lots of, there were Christian Zionists. So it's a very complicated picture. And of course, there were lots of Orthodox Jews who weren't happy with the idea of...
A lot of Jews were not happy about Zionism at all. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. But the Balfour Declaration sort of comes in that context. Mm. The flip side of it, though, is that the British weren't considering the perspectives of people who were in Palestine who weren't so happy about this. And what people don't really know about, most people, is that actually the British had already made a promise to the Sharif of Mecca at the start of World War One. They wanted him to revolt against the Ottomans. So the British High Commissioner in Cairo said, basically, you revolt against the Ottomans for us, which will be very, very helpful to us, and we will give you an independent Arab state. And the British included Palestine within that very expansive Arab state. This is the convincing argument made by historian Peter Shambrook in a recent book. He calls it the policy of deceit. And I think it's a very convincing argument. The British denied this. So they said, well, no, Palestine wasn't.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Part of this Arab state that we promised, but they consistently refused to publish the correspondence between the High Commissioner and the Sharif of Mecca until 1939, when they needed sort of support going into World War II. But that is a context. You have these two claims. The British have made one promise, and then they've gone and made a declaration of intent, the Balfour Declaration, and out of that came significant conflict. And that's where we get to sort of our central character in this story, is the Mufti of Jerusalem, Amin al-Husseini, one of the most controversial Muslim figures of the 20th century, really, because he's well known for his really quite shocking alliances with fascist Italy and Nazi Germany during World War II. So he actually made overtures to the fascist powers, essentially because he wanted to secure declaration that they would support the freedom of Arab states if they won the war. So those were the Axis powers. So it was kind of arch pragmatism. And you see this in some other contexts. So there was a famous Indian freedom fighter who also made overtures to Germany and then tried to get Japan to invade India.
These overtures were in the face of British occupation of India and British occupation of Palestine, the British mandate there. So the Germans were against the British Empire, the Britain having a foothold in these areas. So it was, as you say, it was arch pragmatism that rather than ideological affinity that motivated them.
Yes, I think it's correct to say that there was no ideological affinity between al-Husseini and Hitler. I think we can call this sort of alliance that he sought, I mean, to call it a miscalculation would be a dramatic understatement. It's been the great stain on his historical reputation. But Mufti al-Husseini in the period that we're talking about, 1931, was a very, very different man. So by World War II, he couldn't enter Palestine because he would be arrested by the British. He had to leave after the Arab revolt started in 1936. He became intensely, radically anti-British, whereas during this period, he was actually extremely sort of pragmatic. He worked with the British. He worked under the British mandate. He was so pragmatic, actually, that he agreed to a proposal for a political settlement in Palestine, which would involve a parliament with proportional representation for Jews and Palestinian Arabs, and it would be under British authority. And that plan was blocked by Zionist leaders, including David Ben-Gurion, who's a famous first prime minister of Israel. Yeah. So Mufti al-Husseini was here in Jerusalem in Palestine, and he wanted to have Jerusalem established as a kind of important Muslim political center for the Islamic world. And he saw that that would be very good for the Palestinian cause because it would make everyone sort of interested in it and committed to it. Jerusalem was obviously the third holiest site for Muslims, as it's always been from the start of Islam. But it wasn't considered to be politically crucial at all. So that was Husseini's project. And his great allies in this were Indian Muslim political activists, political figures. And what we tend to forget, it's a kind of airbrushed out of history, is just how important the Indian subcontinent was considered as part of the Muslim world at this time. So the British Empire liked to describe itself as the greatest Muslim power in the world. And the reason it did was...
We're going to pause on the irony of this, because you're absolutely right. I read this before. When I first heard this, I couldn't believe what I was reading. So the British Empire, the British, Queen Victoria, etc., positioning themselves as the greatest Muslim empire in the world. I mean, you couldn't make it up, could you? I mean, it's true.
No. But what's interesting is a lot of Muslims kind of played into that.
They said,
if you're the greatest Muslim power in the world, then, you know, give us this and give us that and support the...
Yusuf Ali, the great translator of the Quran, he was part of the British Empire and was in some ways quite loyal to it. And so it was fairly normal for some people to see it as kind of, this is a Muslim empire, even though, of course, it's run by Christians.
Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely. So the British Empire, Muslim power, according to them. And they also, the reason was, you know, demography. It was just the amount of Muslims in the empire. It wasn't because they considered themselves to be an Islamic empire.
No.
And there were a lot of Muslims in India. It sort of had such a large and such a significant, politically significant Muslim population. So the Khilafat movement, the Caliphate movement in India, which was sort of joint run by Muslim and Hindu leaders, that was immensely important in kind of the creation of the Republic of Turkey, actually, because the British would take into account when they were making policies, they would say, what's Indian Muslim public opinion going to be about this? So Indian Muslims were really important, and they were very engaged with the rest of the Islamic world. So two very important figures for our story here are the Ali brothers, Maulana Muhammad Ali and Maulana Shaukat Ali. Now, although they are generally referred to with the title Maulana, you'd think that they come out of traditional madrasas. But no, they had very anglicized English style educations. They went through the civil service, and then they transformed themselves into journalists, kind of a mix between journalists and political activists, as many politicians were at that time in India. And they started protesting against various British policies. They were arrested during World War One for urging support for the Ottomans. They then went on to become leaders of the Khilafat movement. They were actually very, very close friends with Gandhi. They later fell out of a political squabbling, but they were very, very close friends with him. And Maulana Muhammad Ali was extremely respected across the Muslim world. And he made contact with Mufti Husseini because he became really interested in the Palestinian cause. He saw it as another anti-colonial cause. He said, you know, Muslims should make common causes about the solidarity of different Muslims. And Husseini obviously was very happy about this because he wanted Palestine to gain more and more international recognition. So then, in December 1930, Muhammad Ali and his brother Shaukat Ali are in London for the Round Table Conference, which is a kind of the British were holding these talks between Indian political leaders to try and agree on political reform in India. And Muhammad Ali gave a very significant speech where he stood up and he said to roaring approval that I will not enter India again while it's under British rule.
Wow.
And then he fell ill after that, and he died there in London. So in a way, his words sort of came true. And the Mufti, when he heard about that, telegrammed from Jerusalem over to Maulana Shaukat Ali, and he said, why don't you bury your brother here in Jerusalem? Bring him over and we'll bury him in the precinct of the Al-Aqsa Masjid. Now, this would be a great honor for Maulana Muhammad Ali, of course, and for the family. But it was also very important for the Mufti, because he saw that it would help turn Jerusalem into a kind of Islamic political capital, because here was a great global Islamic political leader, and we'll bring him here and it will be a political event. Mm-hmm. Now, British officials knew this as well, and so did some Zionist leaders who were really very concerned about Muhammad Ali's arrival. So he arrived in on the 23rd of January 1931 on Friday, and the coffin was brought off the boat, and there was an absolute sea of people, of Palestinians there waiting to accompany the coffin along the funeral procession to the Dome of the Rock. And Shaukat Ali was there. He met with lots of notables. He actually met with Jewish leaders there as well. So it's important to note that Maulana Shaukat Ali was not anti-Semitic at all. And actually, not all the Jewish leaders were anti-Muslim either. So that's kind of an interesting and quite crucial nugget. And Muhammad Ali was buried in the precinct of Al-Aqsa. The Mufti gave a speech, a eulogy. Renowned Egyptian thinker Ahmed Zaki Pasha gave a speech as well. Even an Arab Christian poet actually read out a poem that he'd composed in Muhammad Ali's honor. And it was a very kind of, there are some glorious black and white photos of this online of the funeral. And there's a moving quote from Sir Muhammad Iqbal when he was in Jerusalem and he visited the grave, and he commented that Muhammad Ali was such a man that God decreed that he should ascend to heaven from the same place that our prophet did, referencing, peace be upon him, referencing the Mi'raj, the ascension into heaven. So for the Mufti, that was an important moment in establishing Jerusalem as a sort of capital for Islamic politics. And then Shaukat Ali turned to him after the funeral and said, well, how about we hold a conference here in Jerusalem and we invite Muslim notables from across the world, and we agree to lots of stuff about Palestine. Let's set up an Islamic university here. Let's sort of make Jerusalem a kind of Islamic capital. And Mufti Husseini was delighted by this, and they quickly sent out invites all across the Muslim world. And almost instantly, rumors were triggered that there's a grand plot afoot to restore the caliphate, specifically the Ottoman caliphate. Now, there was truth to this. 1931 was a time when everyone was still talking about the caliphate. It had been abolished in 1924 on March the 3rd. We're actually approaching the 100-year anniversary of that. And as soon as the caliphate was abolished by the Republic of Turkey, it was sort of like a starting pistol went off on everyone to start staking their claim to the caliphate. So, you know, the King of Najd thought, well, maybe I should have a go at it. The King of Egypt thought, maybe it could be me. And they started trying to muster support, because the truth was, you know, you couldn't just say you were a caliph and expect everyone to kind of follow you. You could only be a legitimate caliph, really, if you had power and support from enough Muslims across the world. I mean, the Ottoman Empire, they could only really be accepted as the caliphate for hundreds of years by other Muslim polities, because they were extremely powerful. I mean, it didn't really matter that much that they said the Abbasids had kind of transferred the caliphate to them secretly, which was, you know, they didn't have evidence for that story. But it didn't really matter to anyone because they controlled Mecca, they controlled Medina, they controlled Jerusalem, and they controlled Baghdad as well. So they were so powerful that that's why you had an Ottoman caliphate. But now you didn't have an Ottoman Empire. And people wanted the caliphate back. And one of the candidates, was actually the last Ottoman caliph, the last Khalifa Abdul Majid II, who was deposed in 1924 and then exiled to Switzerland, where he declared almost immediately that he said, it's now for the Muslim world to decide in complete liberty upon this vital question of the caliphate. Now, that is an extraordinary statement, because what he was envisioning was not just a kind of restoration of the Ottoman caliphate. It was a reconstitution, a reimagining of what the caliphate would be. This was a caliphate. He wanted a caliphate that uses the prestige of the House of Usman, of the Ottoman dynasty, and gets its support from there. But it has to be kind of chosen and supported by Muslim notables, Muslim leaders from across the world. So an Ottoman caliphate without an Ottoman empire, it was a very modern, unprecedented, and interesting idea. By 1931, he's in the south of France. Shokat Ali left Jerusalem and headed over there to meet Abdul Majid II to make a proposition to him. Because Abdul Majid recognized that to have a caliphate, you need a polity, you need a state of some sort. And he decided that let's revive the caliphate in the Indian subcontinent, which sounds very strange to us today. The Indian subcontinent, why not Arabia? But as I've said, India was considered to be so important. And in the subcontinent, you had a princely state, Hyderabad, which was, it was about around the size of Italy. It had an economy around the size of a smaller European countries. It was a fast modernizing state compared to the British Raj. Governance was relatively good. And the Nizam had financially supported the former caliph in his exile on the French Riviera. And so Abdul Majid married his daughter. This was brokered by Maulana Shokat Ali, and he married his daughter to the son of the Nizam of Hyderabad. And the idea was that the child of this marriage, the firstborn son, can one day be the caliph and the Nizam of Hyderabad. And this was obviously a very long-term plan. They kept it kind of secret. It wasn't for the caliphate to be kind of declared the next day. But also tied in with this is the Congress in Jerusalem. So Abdul Majid's plan was to head over to the Congress and muster support for the Ottoman Caliphate. And all the rumors were based on that kind of fundamental reality. So the Turkish government was constantly pressuring the British government. They were saying, you know, there's a caliphate intrigue afoot. You need to ban the Congress. The French government refused to sort of stop the caliph from leaving the country. Eventually, the British just said, OK, we won't give him a visa to Palestine, so he can't get in. But the British Foreign Office was saying, no, you have to put a stop to this Congress, you know, ban it from happening. And British officials in Palestine said, well, if we do that, there are going to be riots. People are going to go crazy. So the compromise that they came to was that, OK, we'll let the Congress go ahead, but the caliph won't be allowed in. So Shokat Ali was left to do the lobbying on Abdul Majid's behalf. And what essentially happened is that Mufti Husseini realized that we can't explicitly discuss the caliphate because, we'll get arrested or something. So he started briefing very mysteriously the journalists who were asking him questions by saying, we won't elect a caliph at this Congress. And he said, we will deal with the question abstractly, which is a very mysterious way of sort of saying that, you know, we're going to be kind of gauging the temperature and seeing what people think quietly behind closed doors. What did people think about the caliphate? And then the caliph secretary on the French Riviera had all these American journalists coming to him and saying, you know, how do you comment on this? And the secretary just said, the caliph is constantly in contact with the Grand Mufti of Palestine and wouldn't say anything else. So you have all this controversy. And because of that, the King of Egypt refuses to attend. The King of Najd says, I got the invitation too late, which was dubious. and you have all this controversy surrounding the Congress before it even begins. And then the Congress actually takes place in December, on the 7th of December, and it ended up hosting at the end 130 delegates from 22 countries. So a lot of very, very important people came. And a lot of people came who weren't necessarily that important at the time, but they later on became very important political figures. So you had future Prime Minister of Lebanon was there. You had Shukri al-Kuwatli, who would become the President of Syria. You had famous intellectuals as well. So Rashid Ridda, the kind of reformist, modernist Egyptian thinker, he arrived, and sort of people were very happy about that. And then Sir Muhammad Iqbal, the Indian Muslim kind of poet, philosopher, politician, he arrived in Jerusalem to great media fanfare. He was sort of treated as a celebrity. People were really delighted when he came, because his Persian poetry in particular was very well known across the Islamic world. So all the delegates arrived, and then the Congress began under the let's say the watchful and increasingly concerned, increasingly worried eye of the British officials who are monitoring what was going on. So it all began in Al-Aqsa, and they chose Muhammad Hussein Al-Ghita, who was a prominent Shia sheikh from Iraq, to lead all the delegates in prayer at Al-Aqsa. And that must have been quite the sight. You had the Mufti of Jerusalem, Maulana Shokat Ali, Rashid Ridda, all these people praying behind the Shia.
I mean, that must be quite unusual. I mean, it'd almost be unthinkable today for many people anyway, that a Shia would lead prayers of a Sunni gathering like that. And also the very eclectic mixture of people, very diverse. You mentioned a very modernist person. You had Muhammad Iqbal, you had other people. And all praying behind a Shia. So, I mean, was that controversial then, or was that an exceptional occurrence, you think?
It was not. So massive displays of Shia Sunni unity were really kind of all the rage then. And there actually, there was a lot of sort of pragmatism between people who, whatever their kind of personal beliefs were about other people's beliefs, were willing to put it aside. And actually, you had one important figure who wasn't at this Congress, but was the Aga Khan III, who obviously is the leader of the Ismailis. Yeah. And yet he was considered extremely important by the other Indian Muslims at the time. And he lobbied on behalf of the Ottoman Caliphate. During the Khilafat movement. So again, you had people sort of really moving across sectarian lines in a really kind of strangely fluid way. It seems strange.
It does seem strange, but you're saying at that time that was very much in vogue, this kind of cross-sectarian, I don't know, alliance or... so that's
absolutely. It's something that really stands out about this Congress in Jerusalem as well, is that it's really the heyday of kind of unity across the Islamic world. And of course, as we'll see, it wasn't really idyllic at all. But in terms of from the perspective of sectarian differences, it really was. It was the heyday. It was sort of the peak of things. So Mufti Husseini then gave a presidential address after the prayer where he said, we're friends of all, we're enemies of none. And he said he explicitly invoked the idea of the entire Muslim world. So he said, the Congress is here and to provide a common platform for the Muslims of the world so that united they may fulfill the mission of Islam. And then after that sort of rather pleasant opening speech, the British officials in attendance started getting increasingly worried, because the delegates then took an oath to defend the holy places with every bit of strength. They declared a boycott of Zionist goods. They then resolved to create an Islamic university in Jerusalem. And the idea here was to attract Muslims from across the world, and it would establish Palestine as a global hub of Muslim intellectual activity. But this was extremely controversial among the Muslims. So people disagreed on what this university should look like. Yeah. So as you can imagine, Rashid Ridda said, well, there has to be a uniform Islamic curriculum for Muslims across the world. They have to all learned the same thing, and he had a kind of sort of very modernist ideas in mind. The Mufti of Jerusalem said, no, this university has to be as traditional as possible. Shoka Dali said, no, we should teach English, and we should teach French, and we should teach, it should operate like a European university mixed in with a traditional Islamic university. And that was his vision. So people were all disagreeing. And then most controversially of all, scholars from Al-Azhar in Egypt were not happy about it, because they suspected a plan to undermine Al-Azhar by setting this university up as a kind of rival. So
I can see why they might think that, yeah.
Yes, so there was all this conflict. And then Iqbal chimed in saying, are we really going to raise the money to make this university? So and it turns out he was right. In the end, they wouldn't raise enough money to establish the university. But it was the fact that the idea itself and the debate surrounding the idea show what people were thinking at the time, and the problems and the obvious disagreements and disunity. Mm-hmm. But then more significant than that, and most significantly, most controversially, most worryingly for the British, the Congress resolved to form an Islamic company to buy up Palestinian land. This was obviously a counterweight to the Zionist settlement project. So it's considered
a brilliant idea, because that's what a lot of Zionists did. They went around hoovering up property, well, just taking it or purchasing it, and to have it as a counterweight to that. It sounds like a fantastic idea. What happened to that idea?
Well, we'll get onto that, but the idea was established at the Congress, and I'll sort of explain what happened with it after. As you can imagine, it didn't go very well. But when this Congress was announced, I mean, British official, you can imagine they were having a heart attack. And so they took the Mufti aside and they said, hold on, because before the Congress, the Mufti had said to the British that, okay, allow this to go ahead, and I promise you, we won't discuss controversial political topics. Yeah. So the British were obviously horrified when, you know, they discussed controversial political topics, not just in great detail, but also going so far as to carry resolutions condemning colonialism and condemning the sort of alienation of Muslims from control over Islamic lands and Muslim holy places. So the High Commissioner summoned the Mufti, and he asked for an explanation. And Husseini just said, oh, well, I can't control what the delegates are saying. So the British decided to show their hand after that. And a very important figure called Abdurrahman Azam, who would later become the first Secretary General of the League of Arab States, so a very important figure indeed, he gave a very fiery speech, extremely popular, and it had everyone sort of up and cheering and applauding. And he condemned Italian atrocities in Libya. And the British responded by making an example out of him. They rounded him up. They ordered him to be deported, and he was carried through Palestine by a police escort to the Egyptian border. But because the Palestinian press had started publishing details about his speech, he was already instantly a celebrity. And sort of every town that he was taken to, people would be kind of cheering as he came past. And he was actually carried through Gaza, and the Palestinians in Gaza were all gathered to honor him as he passed through as well. So then the Congress carried on. You had Palestinian nationalist Abdul Hadi gave one of the most popular speeches, in which he explained to the delegates, this is the Palestinian cause, and this is what we want, and this is what we consider to be Zionist plan to take over Palestine. So now you have figures from all over the Muslim world who now understand it and see it as, okay, it's got to be a cause for the entire Islamic world. And he actually proposed a rejection of the British mandate, to great enthusiasm, but it was never put in the final official list of resolutions because people would have been arrested, obviously. And then another notable speech was given by Iqbal, Sir Muhammad Iqbal. He was a strong supporter of the Palestinian cause. He actually later said he'd be willing to go to prison for it when he was in India. And he gave a speech warning against nationalism. So he said excessive nationalism is terrible. And he said we should inculcate the spirit of Muslim brotherhood in all parts of the world. And of the two great dangers to Muslims that he highlighted, he said one is materialism, one is excessive nationalisms. Because Iqbal's great idea was that the Muslims should be thought of as a nation, so sort of as a political and communal unit, Muslim nationhood, essentially. And he has a quote where he said in the speech, he said, "I'm not afraid of the enemies of Islam. My fear is from the Muslims themselves. Whenever I ponder, I bow my head in shame over the thought that we are not worthy of the great prophet of Islam, peace be upon him." And Sir Muhammad Iqbal, of course, is today considered among the most influential Muslim philosophers of the 20th century. So his speech went down very well. And I will quote as well a couplet that he composed, a translation of an Urdu couplet that he composed about the Palestinians. So he said about the Palestinians that having been rescued from the tyranny of the Turk, these poor men have been caught in the clutches of civilization. So those were his views on colonialism and Western civilization, essentially. So the Congress went on and it was racked by internal disagreements. You had voting blocks. You had a physical fight broke out at one point between an Egyptian journalist and the Jordanian delegate. And on the face of it, the Congress was a failure. So to answer your earlier question, the Mufti followed up touring around the Muslim world to try and raise money, and they never managed to raise enough money in the end, and the committee eventually had to dissolve. But they did, there were some important wins. So the Nizam of Hyderabad, so the Mufti actually went to India to raise money, and the Nizam of Hyderabad donated money towards the Islamic University in Jerusalem. It was used for the land grant, the Waqf. And the Nizam had actually a record of donating to Jerusalem. So he donated to the upkeep of the Al-Aqsa compound. He paid for its chandeliers. And he also funded a waqf, an endowed hospice in Jerusalem, which was centuries old. And it was actually an Indian Muslim waqf dedicated to the revered 12th century saint, Indian saint Baba Farid, who had famously traveled through Jerusalem and stayed there. And after that, a waqf was set up in his honor. So the university project shuddered to a halt due to lack of funds. The Islamic Land Company eventually failed because they just didn't have enough money. And the real reason why it all sort of couldn't get started again was the Arab revolt began in 1936. And everything went crazy in Palestine. And the Mufti had to leave under threat of arrest. And that's after that, he became very radically anti-British. And
I was looking for that moment in his biography when there's big change, because he goes from being quite as you say, but arch pragmatist with the British to being actually extremely anti-British to such an extent that he sought alliance with fascist Italy or Nazi Germany. Interesting.
Exactly, yes. So it's sort of a sad end. Although he didn't, after World War II, he continued to be a kind of important figure. And so just to sort of finish off, I'll discuss the legacy of the Congress. So despite on the face of it having been a failure, it was very, very significant. So after the event, you had several Arab delegates stayed in Jerusalem to draft an Arab national charter. And remember, these are people who would go on to govern Arab countries after they became independent. In many cases, they lead sort of independence movements against various European empires. And the Congress was the first time that the Palestinian struggle, you know, imagine this, you had an international body of Muslim notables and they gathered to declare that there is a colonial threat here. The Palestinian struggle is a cause for Islam. So the Palestinian struggle became established as a pan-Arab cause and a global Islamic cause. And there's actually a great photo, which you can see in my article online, of the delegates presenting an early version of the Palestinian flag to Maulana Shokat Ali. And the flag is basically looks like the Palestinian flag today, but it had Al-Aqsa in the middle. Mm-hmm. And actually, over the decades, links between Indian Muslims and Palestine, as a kind of, in many ways, a legacy of this moment, remain very strong. So particularly with regards to Hyderabad. So the Imamul Mulk family, very distinguished kind of aristocratic family, they are to this day custodians of Caliph Abdul Majid II's deed, a document signed by the former caliph in 1931 in France, which transfers the Ottoman Caliphate to the princely state of Hyderabad, and they hold it as custodians. I should note that they're not trying to revive the Caliphate, and they have no political motivation for holding it. It's for cultural and historical reasons. But that family actually established ties with the Palestinian Liberation Organization after 1967. So the family hosted Yasser Arafat, the president, the leader of the PLO, in Hyderabad twice. You've had multiple muftis, Mufti of Jerusalem, Sheikh Sabri, in 1998, I believe, came to Hyderabad, was hosted by this family. He laid the foundation stone of a mosque in the Banara Hills. And you actually had the head of the family awarded the Star of Jerusalem, which is one of the highest Palestinian honors given to a foreign national. You know, who would think it in this kind of South Indian state? Mm. And it's because of this extremely kind of rich history that we've largely forgotten today, you know, most people in the world. So that's the kind of the legacy of international connections. There's also the geopolitical legacy. So after World War II in 1949, in recently established Pakistan, Mufti Husseini arrived and convened an international congress, international conference, which he actually billed it as a sequel to the 1931 Congress. After that came another one called the World Muslim Congress, which he chaired in Karachi in 1951. You had representatives of 32 Muslim countries. By now, these were all independent countries, so the picture had changed dramatically. And then the findings of that Congress provided the foundation for the establishment of the OIC, the Organization of the Islamic Conference in 1969. And that was renamed the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC, which exists to this day. And obviously, many would not be very happy with that organization and consider it to be an ineffective international body. But it is nonetheless very significant.
So how does it see itself, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, in terms vis-a-vis the caliphate? Does it comment on that? Does it see itself as a rival or a replacement? Or does it
not at all. Not at all. It's the World Islamic Congress in 1931 was in many ways the moment where the great scramble for the caliphate ended. So after that, you don't have any significant kind of political projects to revive the caliphate. You have lots of other different political projects and other forms of political Islamic projects. I would say that really Abdul Majid II's plan to revive the caliphate ended definitively in 1948 when the princely state of Hyderabad was annexed to India and became part of India. And after that, sort of that whole plan of reviving the caliphate didn't exist anymore.
So is it your judgment as a Muslim journalist now that the idea of the caliphate, is it in the air again politically, or is it completely sidelined? Or without referring to recent events in Britain with a certain thing being banned, without mentioning that, but I mean in terms of the globally, I mean, did you get a sense that it's on the agenda again like it was back in the 30s?
No. Not in a political sense, not at all. However, there is a kind of, you know, what's important about, and when people, a lot of people have a sentimental attachment to the idea of the caliphate. And when I say sentimental, I don't say that to demean the attachment. I mean, in its genuine, purest sense, it's a sentimental kind of adherence to the idea. And the reason is that it's the reason the caliphate holds so much kind of sway over many people as a kind of vague concept rather than a concrete kind of political project, is because it's about Muslim unity. And people really feel very strongly, I think most Muslims in the world, that we should have Muslim unity and there should be more international Muslim cooperation. That's, you know, one thing everyone always says about. It's a very common sentiment when you have events like the current war on Gaza. People say, well, why can't Muslims be more united to deal with this? And so it's that point about Muslim unity that I would say is the biggest takeaway from the story of the World Islamic Congress, because there you have its great strengths in the interwar period and also its obvious political failure as well. So there are two lessons really to be drawn. And what we see is that Congress was a result of people making alliances and connections across national boundaries and across imperial borders, in some ways against empires as well. And today you have a world of nation states and people still relate across nation state borders. We live in a very globalized world, and it's actually more globalized than ever. Muslims and people in general know more about people in other parts of the world than they ever did. Muslims today follow what's happening to Muslims in other places in the world in a way that they simply never could have done in the past.
Well, obviously, with what's happening with Gaza, we see that every day on our Twitter feed or whatever. It's the good and the bad of it. So you're saying the idea is there, is a sentimental attachment, the idea of unity is there. But it's extraordinary. I mean, this Congress, this World Islamic Congress, took place in Jerusalem in 1931. It's nearly 100 years ago, when all these ideas were in the air, and there were serious players, you know, at least invited to it. If you know, they didn't get the invite and couldn't turn up, like the King of Egypt. But why are we still talking near a century later and nothing has happened? I know this is a big question, an entirely different subject. We can't go into it now. But it's just very frustrating, isn't it? We've been here before and we're back to square, well, maybe not square one, we're at an earlier stage in that process of political unity or political uniformity. It's extraordinary, isn't it, that we haven't even got to the 1931 stage yet.
Yes, in many ways it feels like you know, we continue to be in kind of dire straits, but in other ways, I mean, at that time essentially the entire Muslim world, nearly the entire Muslim world, was under colonial rule. So the idea of Muslim sovereignty was, you know, it barely existed. You had sort of a few examples where it existed. It's very different today. You have powerful Muslim countries today. And so people are saying that we want Muslim countries to do this and that. They weren't saying that in the past because those Muslim countries didn't exist. So things are dramatically different, and political situation has been better at certain points in the past. It's also been worse. So there's no reason to be kind of defeatist or sort of, you know, doom and gloom. And like I said, one of the great advantages of today is that globalization means that we're really more kind of, the space between people is really collapsed by the fact that you can sort of, for example, talk to people over camera, things are live streamed. You really have a kind of global solidarity that you weren't able to have in the past. And in the 20th century, it was a new thing that it was unprecedented Muslim engagement with other Muslims in Islamic history, because you had people in London and people in France, in Turkey, Jerusalem, India, who were all Muslims and were all engaging and discussing ideas and actually kind of meeting up with each other, writing to each other. They knew what other people were involved in. So even then, that you had a kind of unprecedented Muslim consciousness forming. And that's only got much stronger over the last century.
Right, right. So that's quite a positive message you're giving there, actually. Yeah. Okay. Well, this is very interesting indeed. And I'm very conscious that maybe it's because we're Westerners, we're aware of European history, but this history, which is also part of Islamic history, as you say, has largely been forgotten. And it's extremely important just to give some depth to our current experience, not just what's happening now, that, you know, we've been here before in some ways, but things have moved on, as you very eloquently described. And it kind of fleshes it out a bit, so we're not just kind of we have some roots in our history. So thank you very much indeed, Imran, for your excellent journalism, and long may it continue. I do recommend people subscribe. You can do. I had to subscribe to Middle East Eye, the website, which is in the link in the description below. Read your articles, Imran, and other excellent articles on Middle East Eye. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. Until next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.